Tell me, she says.
Karen's been arrested.
Arrested? He nods. He must keep his feelings to himself. It wouldn't do to start getting too personal with Bridget. He shouldn't be telling her anything at all, but the beer has loosened his tongue.
And what difference does it make? It will all be in the newspapers tomorrow.
Arrested for what? Bridget says. He wonders if he looks as ghastly as he feels.
Murder.
One hand flutters to her mouth, while the other puts her drink down on the counter beside her. Then Bridget turns her face away, as if she's overcome with emotion. He stands awkwardly, watching her. Finally, she reaches up into the cupboard for another martini glass and pours what's left in the shaker into it. She holds it out to him. He eyes it warily. And then he thinks,
what the hell?
He takes the glass from her, lifts it in a silent, cynical toast, and downs it in one go. Tom! The alcohol hits him hard and fast, making everything fuzzy, blurring lines.
Maybe you should go, he says.
He tries to backpedal the seriousness of the situation. He just wants to get her out of here before he says or does something he shouldn't.
The police are grasping at straws. They don't have any other suspects, and they're trying to hang it on her. But she's got a good lawyer.
He's speaking slowly, carefully, because he realizes he's drunk.
They're going to realize she didn't do it. She told me she didn't do it, and I believe her.
Tom, she says again. He looks at her uneasily. He can see the outline of her breasts beneath her top. He knows those breasts. For a moment, he has a vivid memory of being in bed with her, what she was like. Very different from Karen. He forces the thought aside. There's something you should know. He doesn't like the warning tone he hears in her voice. He doesn't want to hear about any little confidences Karen might have shared with her friend across the street. And he doesn't want another woman, an attractive woman, with whom he shares an erotic history, offering him comfort when he's vulnerable like this. He can feel himself becoming aroused at having her so close. It must be the alcohol. His defenses are down.
I think you should go. Please, Tom says, looking at the floor.
He wants her to leave. You need to hear this, she insists. It's impossible to think in here. It's like being in the middle of a constant brawl. Karen curls into a fetal position on the uncomfortable cot inside her holding cell in the basement of the police station and tries to keep it together as the night wears interminably on. She's surrounded by drunks and prostitutes. The stench is unbearable. She tries to breathe only through her mouth. So far, she has a cell to herself, but every time she hears footsteps and shouts as the cops bring in someone else, she's afraid that they will open her cell door and put them in here with her. She thinks of Tom alone in their bed at home and tries not to cry. If only she were there with him, they could comfort each other. There's no comfort to be had here. Chapter 35. Tom looks up at Bridget warily. That night, the night Karen had her accident, Bridget begins. I was home, sitting at the window. It was around 8:20. I saw Karen come running out of the house.
I know all this, Tom says sullenly.
I watched her get into her car and tear away, and I thought maybe something was wrong. Tom's staring at her now, wondering where this is going. So I got in my car, and I followed her. Tom feels as if his heart has stopped. He hadn't expected that. This is going to be worse than he thought. He wants to cover his ears and refuse to listen, but he just stands there and hears it all.
She was driving a bit fast, but she had to stop at a couple of lights, and I was able to keep up with her, a ways behind. I was worried when I saw her run out of the house like that.
Bridget picks up her martini from the counter and takes a quick gulp, and then another, as if she needs courage for what she has to say next.
I realized she was heading into a bad part of town. I couldn't think why. I was wondering what she was up to. It occurred to me that she might not like me following her, but she's a friend, and I was concerned. I just wanted to make sure she was all right. So I stayed with her, but far enough back so that she wouldn't see me. After a while, she pulled into this little parking lot off the main road. I drove past while she was parking, and then I did a U-turn and came back and parked across the street.
Tom's watching her closely through eyes that refuse to focus. He's trying to tell if she's lying. He's so bad at telling when someone is lying, judging by his past performance at it. He fears that she's telling him the truth. He's thinking that Bridget is a witness, and it's making him sick with fear. She's going to put Karen away.
I was almost afraid to get out of the car, but I was so worried about Karen. I saw her go behind a boarded-up restaurant. I got out of the car and walked closer. And then I heard shots. 3 gunshots.
She closes her eyes briefly, opens them again.
I was petrified. It sounded like they came from inside the restaurant. Then I saw Karen come bolting out of there and hightail it for her car. She was wearing these pink rubber gloves, which I thought was odd. She tore them off before she got in the car. I stood there in the dark, against the building. I'm sure she didn't see me, and watched her take off out of the parking lot. She was driving way too fast. I thought about going after her, but I knew I'd never catch up to her, going at that speed. So, I went into the restaurant that she came out of.
She pauses to catch her breath. Tom's heart is beating wildly, and all he can think is, she didn't actually see Karen pull the trigger.
I got to the door, and I opened it and went inside. It was pretty dark, but I could see that there was a body, a man, dead on the floor.
She shudders.
It was horrible. He'd been shot in the face and the chest.
Bridget walks up closer to him until she's within arm's reach.
Tom. She shot him. She killed that man.
No, she didn't, Tom says.
Tom, I know this is hard for you to hear, but I was there.
Tom says desperately, you didn't see her shoot him. You heard shots. You saw Karen run away. Maybe someone else was in that restaurant. Maybe she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. He knows how frantic he sounds, how foolish.
Tom, I didn't see anybody else come out of the building. And she was carrying a gun when she went in there. I saw her.
You didn't say that you saw her carrying a gun when she went into the building.
Well, I did.
Did she have it when she left?
No.
Did you see the gun there, when you were in the restaurant?
I don't think so.
What do you mean you don't think so?
I don't know, Tom. I didn't pay attention to the gun. It was dark. She must have left it there somewhere. I was too freaked out by the dead body, by what she'd done to notice the gun.
Jesus. Tom's thinking furiously. This is not good. This is very, very bad. He has to know what Bridget's going to do. His head is spinning with fear and alcohol. He says slowly,
What are you going to do, Bridget?
What do you mean?
Are you going to tell the police what you saw?
She looks at him and comes closer. Her eyes soften. She bites her lower lip. She reaches up and touches his face gently. He's frozen in place, confused, waiting for her answer.
She says, "No, of course not. Karen's my friend."
And she kisses him deeply. He reaches for her and succumbs helplessly to the comfort she's offering. Karen hasn't slept at all. She has an arraignment this morning, and right now her lawyer is sitting across from her in a small interview room, trying to get her to drink strong coffee. But it tastes bitter and sour in her mouth, and she pushes it away. Besides, she doesn't think she can keep anything down. She feels grimy, unwashed. Her head aches and her eyes burn. She wonders if this is how she's going to feel for the rest of her life. Is she going to spend the rest of her life in prison?
"Karen, you need to focus," Calvin tells her urgently.
"Where's Tom?" she asks again. "It's 9 o'clock already. Her arraignment is this morning. Why isn't he here? His absence makes her feel abandoned. She doesn't think she can do this if he isn't by her side."
"I'm sure he'll be here," Calvin says. "Maybe he's caught in traffic."
She reaches for the coffee, like a good client. Right now, everything depends on what her lawyer can do for her. Calvin says,
"The evidence against you is all circumstantial, meaning there's no direct evidence, no gun with your prints, no trace evidence from you at the scene, and no witnesses tying you to the crime. At least none that we know of so far. They may find some. The tire track evidence isn't conclusive. The gloves are at the lab, but they haven't gotten any DNA off them yet. The lab's a busy place, but they'll get to it. They'll probably find DNA. I'll fight getting that admitted every way I know how, but they may be able to prove that they were your gloves, in which case we've got a big problem."
"I don't think I killed him," she says stubbornly. He waits a few beats.
"So we have to try to figure out who did. Come up with a plausible alternative theory. Because even if you did kill him..."
The lawyer speaks carefully, as if not wanting to upset her.
"They can't convict unless they can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. It's our job to furnish that reasonable doubt. We have to come up with a credible theory of who might have killed him other than you."
"I don't know. Did he have a new wife? Because if he did, she probably wanted to kill him."
She laughs hollowly.
"No, he didn't."
Calvin presses her.
"You said before that he might have enemies."
"I don't know. I haven't seen him in years. I thought he dealt with some questionable people, but I don't know who they were. I stayed out of the business. I didn't want any part of it."
"I'm going to start having some people look into his business contacts, see if he'd pissed anybody off."
She looks at the clock on the wall and wonders again where Tom is. She's starting to feel uneasy about Tom. Can she count on him? Maybe he doesn't believe her. Maybe he thinks she's a murderer. Is he going to come?
"Did you see anyone else there?" Calvin asks. "Think. Did you hear anything inside the restaurant? Could there have been someone there, hiding in the shadows?"
She tries to concentrate. "I don't know. I can't remember everything. I don't remember being inside. There could have been somebody there."
She blinks her eyes.
"There must have been."
Calvin takes a sip of his own coffee from a styrofoam cup.
"You told me before that you felt that your husband had been in your house in the weeks leading up to the phone call."
"Yes, I'm sure of it," she says. She gives an involuntary shudder. "When I think of it now, it still disturbs me. I wonder if I'll ever stop being afraid of him, even though I know he's..."
"Do you still have the photos on your phone?"
The ones you took of the house in the mornings before you went to work?
Yes, I think so.
Good. Those photos show that you were in a particular state of mind, that you thought you were being stalked by him in your own home. You were in mortal fear. We need to preserve those photos, in case we need them.
But isn't that worse? She asks, her voice catching. If I thought he'd found me and was breaking into the house, stalking me, doesn't it make it look more likely that I killed him?
Yes, the lawyer says.
He pauses.
But it also gives you a defense. If we can prove that he was in your house.
Calvin makes a note on his legal pad.
We need to get fingerprints taken. I'll look into getting that done.
She looks at him with dismay, but says nothing. She knows how bad it looks. No one's going to believe her. Her own lawyer doesn't believe her. And she's not sure about her husband, either. She hears a noise outside in the corridor and looks up quickly. The door opens, and a guard ushers Tom into the interview room. Karen feels immense relief. She wants to ask him what the hell took him so long, but one look at him stops her. He looks like hell, and she's the one who spent the night in a cell. She feels a surge of annoyance. She needs him to pull himself together. She can't do this on her own. She says nothing, but eyes him closely.
Sorry, I overslept, Tom says, flushing. I couldn't get to sleep, and then when I finally did...
He trails off.
She'll be appearing in court soon, Calvin tells him.
Tom nods, as if it's completely normal for his wife to be going to court on a murder charge. Karen wants to shake him. He seems so... removed. Can we have a moment alone? She asks, looking at Calvin. The lawyer takes a quick glance at his watch and says,
Sure, a few minutes.
He gets up with a scrape of his chair and exits, leaving the two of them alone. Karen stands up and takes a step toward Tom. They eye one another. Karen breaks the silence first. You look like hell.
You don't look so good yourself.
It breaks the tension, and they both smile a little. Tom, Karen says, I don't think Calvin believes me. She's testing him. She knows it doesn't really matter what her lawyer believes. His job is to defend her anyway. But she wants to hear Tom say that he believes her. She needs to hear it. I don't think I could have killed him, Tom. And if you don't believe me... He steps forward and takes her in his arms and holds her tight as she presses her face into his chest, stifling a sob.
Shh. Of course I believe you.
It's comforting to be held by him, to hear him say it. Even so, she begins to shake uncontrollably. Suddenly, the enormity of what she's facing is catching up with her. Chapter 36. Across the street from 24 Dogwood Drive, the big picture window is empty. No one sits looking out today. Bridget has things to do. Last night was the beginning of a whole new life for her. She feels as if she might explode with happiness. And if someone else has to suffer for her to be happy, if someone else has to go to jail for the rest of her life, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. Life is a zero-sum game, after all. Bridget thinks back to the day it all happened, the day that has changed everything. It started out like any other day on sleepy Dogwood Drive. She was doing a bit of housework, glancing outside occasionally, when she noticed a strange man poking around the Krupp's house. She turned off the vacuum cleaner and watched him. He mounted the front steps and looked in the window at the top of the door. But she noticed that he didn't knock or ring the bell. He seemed to know that no one was home. There was no car in the driveway. Then he walked around the back. Bridget's curiosity and her indignation were aroused. She wanted to know who he was and what he was doing there. She grabbed her gardening gloves and went out to the bottom of her front yard to tackle the weeds and keep an eye on the man snooping around the crops house. When he reappeared in the front, she stood up and watched him. He waved at her in a friendly way and then walked over to talk to her.
"Hi," he said casually.
"Hello," Bridget responded stiffly, not about to be won over by a pleasant smile and good looks. She didn't know who this guy was. Maybe he was an insurance adjuster or something, and had a perfectly acceptable reason for looking around the Krupp's property. But he didn't look like an insurance adjuster.
"Do you live here?" he asked, indicating her own house behind her.
"Yes," she said.
"You must know the people across the street," he said, tilting his head at the Krupp's house.
She nodded cautiously.
"I'm an old friend," he told her, "of the wife."
"Oh," Bridget said, not sure she believed him. "From where?" He looked at her. All pleasantness fell away, and a mean sort of glint came into his eye.
"From another life."
And then he waved at her dismissively and walked briskly away. The man's demeanor made her feel uneasy. Once he was gone, she returned to the house, thinking about the odd exchange. It made Bridget wonder about Karen. She never seemed to talk about her life before she was with Tom, other than saying that she was from Wisconsin and that she had no family. And another thing, Karen wasn't online at all. Nothing came up on her. She wasn't even on Facebook. Everybody's on Facebook. Bridget remembered Karen's maiden name from when she and Tom were dating. Karen had changed her name to Krupp after the wedding. Bridget got on the computer and Googled Karen Fairfield, but she didn't get any hits. That wasn't too surprising. But the more she thought about the man, about his "from another life" comment, the more curious she became. That was how Bridget got drawn into the internet sinkhole and started researching how people disappear and turn up in a new life as someone else. It wasn't long before she began to suspect, to convince herself, that Karen might not be who she said she was. That's when she called Tom at his office and arranged to meet him that same night. She wanted to tell him about the strange man and her suspicions about Karen. But that evening, when Bridget was about to leave to meet Tom at their old spot down by the river, she saw Karen peel out of the house in a desperate hurry. And because of the man's odd visit earlier in the day, Bridget followed her instead. Tom could wait. She saw what she saw. And now, everything is different. She thinks about what happened with Tom the night before, and a languid warmth begins somewhere low and spreads throughout her body. How she's missed him. She hadn't even realized how much until she kissed him again. That kiss, sensuous and dark, was fraught with all sorts of delicious undercurrents and memories. His mouth felt and tasted just like she remembered. Pleasure traveled along her body in a current. That kiss left her breathless. They shared a past, and it was all revived in that kiss. When it was over, and he pulled away and looked at her, she could tell that he was as blown away by it as she was. And then she'd taken him by the hand and led him upstairs to the bedroom, where they made love in Karen and Tom's bed. The same bed she and Tom used to make love in, before Karen moved in. That interloping bitch. Bridget thinks about the lewd things she and Tom did together the night before, and feels that glow again. She remembers how afterward, a feeling of great power and wickedness had come over her. She propped herself on her elbow, full breasts on display, and looked at Tom lying naked and vulnerable in the bed beside her. She walked her fingers slowly up his leg and said, "You don't want me to tell the police what I saw, do you?" He'd looked at her in fear.
"No."
There's no mistaking it, she thinks now. The connection they share. Tom loved her once, she's sure of it. And he will love her again. He will be in her thrall once more, like he was before. Tom knows now what Karen has done. That she's a murderer. Because Bridget was there. And she told him. Bridget has promised Tom that she isn't going to say anything to the police. But Bridget has a plan. There's no going back. It's all going to be perfect. Tom is shaken to his core by the arraignment. It was a circus in the courtroom. Too noisy to hear anything, too much going on, and all of it happening so fast. He'd expected it to be a lot more solemn and easier to follow. Karen went up in front of the bench with Jack Calvin when her name was called. Tom sat in the courtroom, fairly far back, the only place he could get a seat. He could only see Karen from behind. The size of the courtroom and the tumult all around made her seem small and defeated. He had to strain to hear. It was all over in a couple of minutes, and then she was being escorted out. He stood up. She glanced back at him, frightened, as they led her out of the courtroom. Tom sat back down in his seat, stunned, unsure of what to do. Calvin saw him and approached. "You might as well go home," he said. "They're transporting her to the county jail. You can see her there later today." So Tom had gone home. He didn't know what else to do. Then he'd called in sick indefinitely. He knows that no one is going to believe he's sick once the news gets out. Now he goes into the bedroom and stares at the rumpled sheets with horror. He should never have slept with Bridget again. How could he have let that happen? He knows how. He was very lonely and very drunk, and she was sympathetic. She could also be irresistibly sexy, and they had all that history. But then, afterward, she made it quite clear that sleeping with her had been the price of her silence. Now he feels sick and scared. What if she's lying? What if Bridget hadn't been there at all? Either way, she's manipulating him to get back into his bed. What if she visits Karen in jail and tells her what he did? If he were to tell Karen that he slept with Bridget to protect her, would she believe him? Tom suddenly rips the sheets off the bed in a rage and throws them in a ball on the floor. He'll put them in the laundry and wash any trace of Bridget from their bed. But getting rid of Bridget, that might not be so simple. Jack Calvin takes a quick flight to Las Vegas, Nevada, to visit the counseling center for battered women that Karen used when she was married to Robert Traynor. He's already checked. It's still there. And there are people there who remember her. They're expecting him. He's also hired a private investigator in Las Vegas to look into Robert Traynor's business associates. Maybe something will turn up there, but he's not particularly hopeful. He lands and takes a cab into the city. He soon locates the Open Arms Women's Shelter and Counseling Center. The building is a bit run down, but it's trying hard to be a happy, warm, and welcoming place. There are children's paintings up everywhere. He goes to the information desk. Very soon, the director of the facility comes out to meet him and takes him back to her office. "I'm Teresa Wolchak," she says, offering him a seat. "Jack Calvin," he says. "As I told you on the phone, I represent a woman, now living in New York State, who used to come here for counseling 3 or 4 years ago, it would be now. Georgina Traynor." She nods. "May I see some identification?" "Yes, of course." He reaches for his ID. He also opens his briefcase and hands over a letter that identifies the writer as Georgina Traynor and gives her informed consent to disclose information to her lawyer, Jack Calvin. She pushes her glasses up higher on her nose and reads it. Then she nods briskly. "Okay, how can I help?"
My client, Georgina Traynor, has been charged with the murder of her husband, Robert Traynor.
Teresa looks at him and nods tiredly.
And now the law needs her to justify herself. She's accused of killing a man. They need to see justice done. If what she says is true, I don't think a jury will have a very difficult time seeing it from her point of view, that she was frightened for her life.
The counselor who saw your client most regularly is a woman named Stacy Howell. Let me get her for you. Soon Calvin and the counselor are closeted together in a small private office. Stacy, a no-nonsense black woman with a soft voice, brings Georgina Traynor's file with her and opens up immediately when she's read the letter.
I remember her, sure. You would think I wouldn't because I see so many, all with the same sad story, but I remember her. Georgina isn't that common a name, and I really liked her. I saw her for at least a year.
What was she like?
She was like all the other women who come here. Scared shitless. Sorry to be so blunt, but nobody seems to get what these women go through. The man she was married to was a real bastard. She felt trapped. She felt that if she told anyone but us what he did to her, nobody would believe her.
So what did you tell her? Did you tell her to leave him?
It's not that simple. We have women living here for their own protection. It's difficult to get the supports in place. The restraining orders don't seem to do much good.
She sighs in discouragement.
I told her she had some leverage. He had a good business. I told her that if she wanted to, she could leave him and get a restraining order and threaten to make it public. Shaming them sometimes works. But she was too afraid.
Calvin nods.
One day she didn't show up for her appointment. We heard that she'd jumped off the Hoover Dam Bridge. They didn't recover the body. I read about it in the paper.
She shakes her head sadly, remembering.
I thought for sure that he'd killed her, that he'd tried to make it look like suicide.
Did you go to the police?
Of course I did. They looked into him, but he had an airtight alibi. He was working. Lots of people saw him throughout the day. They dropped it.
He didn't kill her, Calvin says, indicating the letter.
No, she got away after all. Good for her.
But now she's facing a murder charge.
She killed him?
Stacy says with surprise. She puffs air sharply out her nose.
He had it coming, the son of a bitch.
And then she looks at him in distress and says,
What's going to happen to her?
Chapter 37. Detective Rasbach is pretty certain that from here on out, the Krupp case is going to be fairly straightforward. It's like a puzzle. Difficult at first, but once you have the outline, all the pieces start slipping neatly into place. It seems quite clear to him that Karen Krupp is a killer. He feels sorry for her, though. In different circumstances, he thinks, it's unlikely she would ever have killed anyone. If she'd never met Robert Traynor, for instance. They know now how Traynor tracked her down. They've looked at his computer, which they had sent in from Vegas by the Las Vegas police. Traynor had been systematically searching websites of accounting and bookkeeping firms all over the U.S. He'd bookmarked a page on the website of Simpson and Merritt, Tom Krupp's employer. And there she was, in the background, at an office Christmas party, standing beside Tom Krupp, who had a profile on the same website. It's so difficult to truly disappear, Rasbach thinks. Rasbach wonders why Traynor went to such efforts to find her. He obviously hadn't been convinced by her suicide, perhaps because her body had never been recovered. He believes he has a solid case to take to the district attorney. Although the physical evidence is not yet conclusive, the circumstances are compelling. Despite steady door-to-door work on the surrounding businesses and apartments in the area, they have not been able to find any witnesses to the crime. Rasbach recalls his unproductive interview with Karen Krupp. She's clearly terrified. He feels sorry for Tom Krupp, too.
He doesn't feel the least bit sorry for Robert Traynor. Detective Jennings knocks on the open door and enters Rasbach's office. He's holding a paper bag with wrapped sandwiches in it. He offers one to Rasbach and sits down.
"Someone called in a tip in the Krupp case," he says.
"A tip," Rasbach says wryly. He glances down at the newspaper open on his desk. A local housewife, Karen Krupp, has been arrested for the murder of a previously unidentified man in an abandoned restaurant on Hoffman Street. That man has now been identified as Robert Traynor of Las Vegas, Nevada. No other details are known at this time. Karen and Tom Krupp aren't talking to the press, and the police made only a very basic statement after the arrest, giving the names of the people involved. No details. But it's not every day that an attractive, respectable suburban housewife is charged with murder. The press is going to be all over this. Nobody knows yet that Karen Krupp used to be someone else, that she faked her death, or that she'd previously been married to the victim.
"Yeah, I know," Detective Jennings says, following Rasbach's gaze to the newspaper. "Lots of crazies out there. The calls will probably start to come flooding in."
"What did he say?"
"It was a she."
"Did she leave a name?"
"Nope."
"They never do," Rasbach says. Jennings finishes chewing a big bite of his sandwich and swallows.
"She said we should search the Krupp property for the murder weapon."
Rasbach raises his eyebrows, waves his sandwich in the air.
"Karen Krupp shoots the guy, panics, and flees. The gun wasn't on the scene, and it wasn't in the car. So where's the gun? It would be nice if we had the gun, and if we could prove that it was the gun that killed him, and if we could connect that same gun to Karen Krupp. But if she still had the gun with her when she left the scene, she either stashed it somewhere nearby. Not likely, as she seems to have been in a full-blown panic and we would have found it, or she threw it out the car window. And then, after getting out of the hospital, she went back to pick it up or find it and put it back in her house somewhere. I don't know, like maybe in her underwear drawer."
He starts unwrapping his sandwich.
"An incredibly stupid thing to do. And she's not stupid."
"Yeah, not likely.
I don't think we are going to need any tips from the public to solve this one," Rasbach says, and takes a bite of tuna salad on whole wheat.
Later that afternoon, Tom goes to visit Karen at the county jail. He stands by his car in the parking lot for a minute, staring queasily at the big, hulking brick building. He doesn't want to go in there. But he thinks of Karen and screws up his courage. If she can survive in there, he can at least put on a brave front when he visits. He makes his way through the front doors of the prison, past the guards to the security desk. He must get used to all these barriers, doors and guards and procedures and searches, to get to talk to his wife. He wonders how she's doing. Will she be holding up well? Or is she going to be a mess? When he asks her, will she tell him the truth? Or will she try to protect him and tell him that she's managing just fine? Finally, he gets to see her in a large room full of tables. He spots her at one and takes the seat across from her, under the watchful eyes of the guards at the front of the room. There are other visits going on around them, at other tables, but if they keep their voices low, they have enough privacy to talk.
"Karen," he says, his voice breaking at the sight of her.
Instantly, his eyes sting with tears. He brushes them away, tries to smile through them. Tears spill down her face.
"Tom," she swallows. "I'm so glad you came. I thought you might not."
"Of course I came. I will always come see you, whenever I can, Karen. I promise," Tom says desperately. "Until we get you out of here."
He's overwhelmed with guilt and shame for what he's done with Bridget, while Karen was in jail.
"I'm scared, Tom," she says.
She looks as if she hasn't slept at all. Her hair is unwashed. She seems to notice the way he's looking at her and says,
I can't take a shower in here whenever I want, you know.
Is there anything I can do? He asks hopelessly. He feels utterly powerless. Can I bring you anything?
I don't think you're allowed to.
This almost makes him break down. He has to stifle a sob. He's always loved to bring her surprises. Chocolates, flowers. He can't bear to think of her Spartan future in here. She's always loved her little luxuries. She's not suited to prison. As if anyone is.
I'll find out, okay?
She tilts her head at him.
Hey, cheer up. I'm going to get out of here. My lawyer says so.
Tom doubts that Calvin would have made any such assurances to her, but he pretends that they all believe that she'll be out soon. They just have to hang tough. But there's something he has to tell her.
Karen, he says cautiously, his voice very low. I was talking to Bridget last night.
Bridget?
Karen repeats, surprised. He hopes she doesn't notice the slight flush that he can feel coloring his face. His guilt. He glances down at the table for a moment, avoiding her eyes, then looks up again.
Yes. She came over to talk to you. She didn't know that you'd been arrested.
Okay.
But she told me something.
What?
Karen says, her voice also low but now wary.
She said that the night of your accident, she saw you go out the front door.
He looks right into his wife's lovely, lying eyes. He keeps his voice very quiet.
She told me she followed you that night.
Karen becomes suddenly alert.
What?
She says she followed you in her car, far enough behind you that you wouldn't notice her. Karen remains perfectly still, and Tom's heart sinks as he watches complex emotions play across her face. It's true, he thinks, what Bridget said.
What else did she say?
She said she followed you until you parked, and then she parked across the street. She watched you go to the back of the restaurant. She heard gunshots. 3 shots. And then she saw you run out of the building to your car. She says she saw you tear off the gloves and get in the car and speed away.
His wife says nothing. She is clearly shocked by this news.
Karen, Tom whispers.
She still says nothing.
Karen,
Tom says it urgently. He lowers his voice, instinctively looking around to be sure they aren't overheard. But no one else can hear them in the room's chatter.
She was there.
Maybe she's lying.
I don't think so, Tom says quietly. How would she know about the gloves?
Karen is quiet, her eyes wide. He can see a vein throb in her throat. Nobody knows about the gloves, except the police. Tom shakes his head.
I think she was there. I think she saw you. She says you had a gun in your hand on the way in, and you ran out with just the gloves on the way out.
And what did she do then?
Karen asks, her hands gripping the edge of the table.
She went into the restaurant and saw the body, Tom says.
He watches Karen go pale and feels bile rising in his throat.
She freaked out and got the hell out of there and went home.
He leans as close to her as he dares under the guard's watchful eye, disturbed by the story her face is telling him.
Karen, tell me the truth. Do you really not remember?
He says it gently, coaxingly. He forgives her, if only she will tell him the truth. He can see by the look on her face how terrorized she must have been. Surely a jury will see it too.
She's a witness,
Karen says, as if she can hardly believe it.
Did you kill him?
Tom presses, his voice so low it's almost inaudible. He looks around again, No one's paying any attention to them.
You can tell me, he says. Only me.
She looks back at him and says, I don't remember, but I don't think I could shoot anyone. If only he could believe her. He sits back in his chair, full of despair. Maybe the jury will understand why she did what she did.
Even so, she'll still be in jail for years and years, Tom thinks bleakly.
It's not fair, when it was all Robert Traynor's fault. If he hadn't come after her again, if he'd just left her alone, they wouldn't be sitting here right now, in a county jail, frightened and miserable. Even if she can't admit the truth to him, maybe she can't even admit it to herself. Maybe she's completely repressed it from her conscious mind. He thinks he still loves her, this different, terribly wronged Karen. He can't let her go to prison for the rest of her life, living without her through empty days, empty nights, thinking of her locked up in a cage. It's unimaginable.
She's a witness, Karen says again, pulling herself together and leaning toward him.
Even if they're able to prove the gloves are mine, that still isn't proof that I killed him. It's only proof that I was there.
I was there, but I...
She looks desperately at him.
If I were able to kill him, I would have done it when I was married to him, don't you think? If Bridget says she heard shots and saw me running out right after, she must be lying.
Karen looks at him with fear in her eyes.
Why would she lie?
Tom shakes his head and says nothing. He doesn't think Bridget is lying. He thinks Karen is lying. Or at best, she really doesn't know what happened.
I don't think she's going to say anything, Tom says finally.
How can you be so sure?
Karen whispers back, anxiety in her voice.
She's your friend, he says uneasily.
What kind of friend makes up a lie like that? Maybe she followed me. Maybe she was there. But maybe it didn't happen the way she says it did.
Tom looks at Karen unhappily. He leans forward again and says,
We have to make sure they never find out that she was there. They have no reason to think she knows anything about it. They have no reason to call her as a witness. She's not going to say anything.
I hope you're right, Karen says apprehensively. But I don't trust her anymore.
Tom doesn't trust Bridget either, but he does think she's telling the truth. Chapter 38. Karen starts to tremble when Tom leaves. As she watches him go, it's as if her last connection to the outside world is disappearing. In here, she fears her real self might just dissolve. Watching his retreating back, she almost screams, Don't leave me here! But then a guard comes for her, and she must hold it together, because if she doesn't, if she shows weakness, she will never survive in here. It all may work out, Calvin has told her. But it's getting harder and harder to believe it. She's shocked that Bridget followed her that night. She suddenly remembers something she glimpsed from the corner of her eye, in the plaza. Something familiar that didn't quite register at the time. Bridget's car. She remembers it now. Why can't she remember the rest? It's driving her mad. Why did Bridget follow her? What possible reason could she have had? It can only be because Bridget saw her tear out of the house so fast. She sensed drama and couldn't resist. What incredibly bad luck for her that Bridget lives across the street. Tom is on his way to his car when he gets a call from the office. His heart sinks. He doesn't want to deal with work. He's going to have to tell them that he needs some time off. He hasn't been to the office since Karen was arrested the day before, and he'd flown out when Jack Calvin called. And now the story is all over the papers. He reluctantly takes the call.
Tom, James Merritt says.
Merritt is a senior partner at Simpson and Merritt. Tom has never much cared for him.
Yes, Tom says impatiently. We need you to come into the office, Merritt says in his smooth, commanding baritone.
Now? I have some things I have to sort out. Half an hour in the boardroom. The call is disconnected.
Fuck!
Of course they know that Karen's been arrested for murder. That won't play well with the clients. He drives home quickly to put on a suit and then heads to the office. He parks in his usual spot and sits for a minute in the car, preparing himself. With a strong sense of foreboding, he climbs out of the car and strides into the building. He takes the elevator up to the boardroom on the 12th floor, a room he rarely visits. When he steps inside, he sees the partners all seated around the large, smooth table. The murmuring in the room stops suddenly in an unnerving way, and Tom knows that, of course, they were talking about him, about his wife.
Have a seat, Tom, Merritt says, directing him to an open chair.
Tom sits, looking around the room at the members of the firm gathered there. Some of them meet his eyes curiously, others don't.
What's this about? Tom asks boldly. We were hoping you would tell us, Merritt says.
Tom is anxious. He's never really fit in. He's not from the right background. He doesn't come from money, doesn't play golf in the right clubs. He's risen as far as he has because he's a damned good accountant. And he works like a fiend, never complaining. But they were probably never going to make him partner. And now this.
If this is about my wife, I don't think it's any of your business, Tom says. On the contrary, we do think it's our business, Merritt says.
He gives Tom a cold look.
We're sorry for your troubles, he continues, not looking particularly sorry. He and the other partners look more appalled than anything. But we are naturally concerned about how it looks.
Merritt sweeps his eyes down the table at the other partners, most of whom are nodding silently. Tom stares at each of them in turn, quietly furious.
There's no question you're an excellent accountant, Tom, Merritt says. But you must understand our position. We have to think of our clients, their sensibilities. I'm afraid we have to suspend you without pay, until such time as the charges against your wife are dropped.
He lets that sink in.
Of course, he adds, you're free to pursue opportunities elsewhere. We would be happy to give you a good reference.
Tom blinks rapidly. They're firing him. He stands up and, without uttering a word, walks out of the boardroom, slamming the door resoundingly behind him. He tears out of the parking lot in a fury. He needs money for Karen's legal bills, which are going to be enormous. And now he has no way to pay them. Bridget sees Tom return home. She watches him get out of the car and slam the door, as if he's angry. He strides up the steps and disappears inside the house. Her heart picks up speed. She wonders what's happened now. The sooner he's rid of Karen, the sooner he has her as a fixture in his life, the happier he'll be. Bridget believes this with her whole heart. It's so perfect that Karen is out of the way, in jail. When Tom visits her, Bridget thinks, how different she must be, with her unwashed hair and ugly prison clothes. Karen was always so attractive. She has those perfect features and that expensive pixie haircut that shows off her fine bone structure. She won't have that flattering cut for much longer.
How fun it would be to visit her, Bridget imagines. She would like to visit Karen in jail and see the new, unattractive Karen for herself. How satisfying that would be. Bridget always sensed a certain entitlement in Karen. But now, Bridget is the one who's entitled to everything, including Tom. She will have all of Karen's nice things, including her husband. Soon Karen will understand that, and she won't be able to do a damn thing about it. Bridget will wait until later, until Bob has come home to grab supper and has gone out again. Really, the man just comes home to eat and sleep. And now she's glad, because it leaves her free to do as she pleases. This afternoon, she had her hair cut short, in the same pixie style that Karen wears. And she had a mani-pedi. Bridget knows that Karen regularly treats herself to mani-pedis. Or at least, she used to. She won't be doing that anymore. Bridget smiles when she thinks that maybe Karen will be getting homemade tattoos in prison instead. She even knows which nail salon Karen went to and who cut her hair, because Karen had told her. Now Bridget regards herself in her bathroom mirror and likes what she sees. Gone is the shoulder-length brown hair with a boring middle part. The new, short, flirty cut makes her look completely different. She loves it. As she sat in the stylist's chair and watched her hair fall to the floor in clumps, she could feel her old life and her old self falling away. She feels like a gorgeous butterfly emerging from a long sleep. If she's going to slip into Karen Krupp's life, she's going to do it right. She will be everything Tom wants her to be, but more. She holds her hands out in front of her and admires her professionally done nails. Soon she will go across the street and see Tom again. She quivers with excitement. He won't dare turn her away. Chapter 39. Jennings pops his head in Rasbach's door again at the end of the day. Rasbach looks up.
What is it? Rasbach asks.
We got another call about the Krupp case from the same woman.
Already? What did she say this time?
She asked why we weren't searching the Krupp's property for the murder weapon.
Rasbach sits back in his chair, while Jennings takes his usual seat in front of Rasbach's desk.
So she knows we aren't there searching. She must be keeping an eye on the place. A neighbor, maybe.
Yep. I wouldn't have bothered you with it, but she said something else that rang some very loud bells.
What? Rasbach says sharply.
She asked me whether we got the gloves.
Rasbach leans forward intently.
Nobody knows about the gloves.
Only the police and Karen and Tom Krupp. There has been nothing in the newspapers about the gloves.
This woman does.
We might have a witness, Rasbach says, or at least somebody who knows something.
He feels a little thrill of adrenaline.
There's no way Karen Krupp could have put the murder weapon back in her house, Rasbach says. We talked about this earlier today. It wasn't in the car when she crashed, and if she'd hidden it or thrown it out the window, we would have found it.
Maybe she wasn't the only one there, Jennings suggests. Maybe someone else was there and picked up the gun.
Rasbach looks at him and nods.
Yeah. We'd better get a warrant.
One of the worst things for Tom is that he can no longer talk to Karen whenever he wants. He never realized how much he relied on hearing her voice throughout the day, and on the emails and texts they exchanged. She was always there, and now she isn't. He can only talk to her when she gets to use the phone at the jail, and he doesn't know when or how often that will be, and they won't be able to say much. He can only visit during visiting hours. She has been put away. How apt that description is. And he's here, alone in the house. Tom feels like he's going out of his mind, but it must be so much harder for her. Being trapped